All right, after once again being reminded to turn on the tape recorder, this is the April 12th, 2018 Statutory Interpretation Administrative Practice class. Thank you to Courtney and Natalie for reminding me to turn on the recorder. I was reminding everyone that we are looking at judicial review of agency action. And as part of that process, we had begun by looking at the famous Whitefish case, the Nova Scotia Foods case, which dealt with an attempt by the FDA to essentially require seafood processors to bake their fish to avoid botulism, to the point it turned into, at least for Whitefish, gelatinous soup. Now, fun case, interesting issues. For those of you who eat fish fillets, I'm sure you'll think of this case now for the rest of your life every time you buy a fish fillet. But the takeaway is, remember, this was a Second Circuit case, one of the earlier cases, talking about the predicates for agency action. And the key thing there was, one, records. You must have a contemporaneous record that is linked to the decision issued by the agency. You can't get sued and then an agency afterwards scurry and generate post hoc a rationalization for your action. Keep that in mind. It's going to come up next week when we talk about a different case. In addition, you have to offer a statement explaining your rationale for the decision by the agency. And here, it was a general statement offered up under Section 553 of the Administrative Procedure Act, which the agency failed to point towards any kind of record or evidence to support its determination to require industry-wide application of the TSS standards, even though it would effectively wipe out the whitefish industry. Now, a few other hidden Easter eggs to take away with that. The record requirements are not hardwired into the APA. The court was focused on what the agency had to generate for the court to be able to effectively judicially review the agency decision. So what you'll find is that the substance and detail and parameters of agency records are not driven as much by the APA as they are by courts forcing agencies to explain better what they're doing. Also, remember this case deals with informal rulemaking. Remember our matrix? Informal, formal, rulemaking, adjudication. Remember, because the processes and some of the standards of review shift as you navigate to different quadrants of that matrix we talked about. So now I'm going to take a deep breath, slow down a little bit, and ask any questions about Nova Scotia before we turn to the workhorse for today, which is, I'll tell you, you got to know it by name, you got to know it when you practice, the State Farm Motor Vehicles decision. Y'all feel fairly comfortable with sort of the ground rules, what agencies have to do to create records, what the records must contain, and how they link the records to the agency's decision. Oh my God, Cody's wearing a tie.
Oh, you're going to see me in a tie.
Every time I look over here, I'm going to lose my train of thought now. Hunter?
I just had a general question about substantive judicial review of agency rules generally. So when we're in this category, where did an actor say that we're dealing with agency action always?
Yeah, well, for the cases we're in, yes. Can I do a small flag for you? Because I suspect, I know what you may think about, which is what counts as an agency action?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, put it this way, it's easy if it's a rule, it's easy for regulation, it's easy if it's an adjudicatory decision. It gets a little weirder when you're starting to talk about things that are in that gray land in between, like guidances, interpretive statements, letters, postings to websites, and my favorite, Twitter announcements. Are those agencies? You guys laugh. I'm sure there's a law review article being written right now about whether or not the Administrative Procedure Act applies to Twitter announcements. Really?
I'm quoting what he
puts on the end. He puts lots of things at the end of his tweets, so I've noticed that they're all usually all caps and usually with exclamation points afterwards. Unfair. All right. The other thing is it has to be final. And that's where a lot of you are going to wash up on the rocks when you try and represent someone before an agency. Not because you've made a bad judgment call, but just because of the way the system is wired. You cannot sue under the APA until you have final agency action, which means that a lot of agencies will announce years in advance what they intend to do, and people like your clients may want to make very big decisions and need to have some certainty. You can't sue to force some type of judicial clarification until the agency actually issues a final determination. That's hugely important. Now, I will add, of course, there's always wiggle room. There are certain things the agency can do where you can claim it's not final and you can push back. I'm going to save that for the ad law class with Professor Kumar. But I just wanted to make sure, Hunter, I got to the heart of your question today. Is that anything else you'd add to that? All cool? All right. So that then brings us to the case that really goes into the heart of this dark land of judicial review of agency action. That is the State Farm Motor Vehicle Association, Motor Vehicle Manufacturers Association versus State Farm. Sorry, just mixing those up. So with that in mind, I'm going to turn to Huey in a second. But before I do, I want you to envision something in your minds. Picture me at the age of 17, wearing a Save Barton Creek t-shirt and flip-flops, laying on my back under my old Ford Maverick, which was, yes, bright lemon yellow with a white top, with a screwdriver about yay long, prying out part of my seatbelt. And let that graphic image linger in your mind as we start talking about what's really involved in this case. So with that, Huey, walk us through exactly what's at issue here in this case, and why do we care?
So this is a quick history that's presented in the book. Starting in 1929, motor vehicles have become the leading cause of death and injuries in the United States. So Congress acted real swift, and in 1966, 37 years later, again, Motor Vehicle Safety Act. And that pretty much directed, it required a few things. It directed the Secretary of Transportation to issue safety standards using objective terms. It required that the Secretary consider available data to propose and good standards and to explain the extent to which those standards will contribute to carrying out the purposes of the law of reducing deaths and reducing injuries. And then further, it authorized judicial review under the APA, Section 706, that we, oh, there's a timeline.
I just want to make your life easier.
Since it does, yeah. For all orders establishing, amending, or revoking a standard, remember that word revoking, because that's a key in this case. And then in 1967, so as y'all see up there, the original Department of Transportation rule for safety belts comes out, and that's under the Ford administration. And it strengthened. It was strengthened in 1969 by proposing an installation of passive restraints, and required them in 1970. It was further strengthened in 1972 by requiring both automatic seat belts and airbags. Passive restraints are either airbags or the seat belts that automatically like lock you in. I've never been in a car that does that.
Oh, that hurts. I'm curious, have any of you actually gotten in cars with automatic seat belts? Yeah, okay, so they're still out there somewhere. It's a weird feeling. It's like this giant hand is bringing a seat belt around you, like you're being sealed in an alien cocoon. Let's take my word for it, as someone who went through that, they were incredibly unpopular when they were first proposed. Let's keep going.
So then they were incredibly unpopular. Congress intervened, listening to the people, and it got rid of the ignition interlock and the buzzer requirements from the safety standards. So pretty much, if you didn't buckle up, you couldn't start your car, or a really obnoxious buzzer would go off. And it also gave itself a veto power over the agency for certain standards that would otherwise be satisfied by the CFO. The administration changes again, and then and we get to President Reagan. In between that, we had, okay, so first we had Secretary Coleman under President Ford, Republican. Then we had Secretary Brock Adams under Carter, Democrat.
I'm detecting a theme here.
There's a theme where under a certain, under the Ford administration, you know, the regulations were proposed, and then they were strengthened under the Carter administration, and then under the Reagan administration, they were, the rule ended up getting rescinded by Secretary Andrew Lewis. And it pointed to
Can I pause for a quick moment? Oh, sure. It's easy to sort of say Republican, Democrat, Republican, Democrat, Republican, Democrat, but you know, this actually, if you go back to the original act, goes back to LBJ, really. So it, here's the thing. I fall prey to that categorical assumption as well, but I just want to at least, for those of you, flag, one of those names should be familiar to you from one of our Harvard cases. How many of you remember William Coleman? Remember the guy who got appointed to argue as an amicus because the government backed out at the last point in one of the cases? I just want to say, he was a Republican, he was an administrator, he was at the Department of Transportation, but for those of you interested, I just want to alert you, he was the first African-American clerk of the Supreme Court. He was also the secretary at a cabinet level for African-Americans at a time when it was still fairly rare. He was the one who was on the Warren Commission, who after JFK was assassinated, flew down and interviewed Fidel Castro in Cuba for 6 hours to see if Cuba was involved in the assassination attempt, and came back and said no, which looks the guts. So there are Republicans, and then there are, I think, men of great stature who stand above party affiliation. So I would,
Even make it to Cuba. I mean, they had to meet on a fishing boat, like with Castro. So
you knew that.
Yeah.
It was interesting. What I thought was fun was when they asked him about it, he first said, well, of course I did. And they said, where is the information from the interview? And he said, well, it damn well better be in the National Archives. And then they asked him again a few weeks later, and he said, I deny everything. Someone got hold of him. So anyway, that was an aside. I just want, for those of you who are interested, he's a fascinating man, and he'll pop up again before we're done. But, so now I've thoroughly derailed your excellent lucid presentation here.
So rather than focusing on, I guess, the partisan changes, it is important to note that there are at least administration changing, because you won't suddenly see a change in policy at the Transportation Department, especially with regard to the requirement of these automatic seatbelts, which were really unpopular. In 1981, however, the rule got rescinded by Andrew Lewis under President Reagan. It pointed to industry changes and to the detachability of seatbelts, which would render them useless, which you were referring to at Barton Springs, you know, under your car. Were you detaching the seatbelt?
No, I was actually detaching the buzzer. The buzzer was really it was obnoxious by design. There was this really big thrill of satisfaction in pulling that damn thing out of the dashboard. It really was satisfying. But getting perhaps a little bit more detail here, you said it was revoked in 1981.
Yes.
So when did Reagan take office?
In 1980, in January 1981.
So how quickly does this process seem to you that it took place?
It didn't seem like they went through that tedious comment period and review period that we had gone over two classes ago.
It
seemed like a very rushed decision.
Yeah, that, in a trial that would be classified as a leading question, so thank you for nailing that one down. I will simply point out, look for comparison to our current administration. This is not a political comment, but there is a strong, similar deregulatory agenda where several administrators who came in, they're still trying to get rules proposed. So the fact that they walked in January, announced they're going to revoke it in February, proposed they were going to revoke it in April, and actually had it off the books by October was something that was at light speed by the administrative state standards. So this is, you can tell already, this is a highly unusual rulemaking. Now, having put in the editorial comment,
So that's the background, and that's where we're at. The Motor Vehicle Manufacturers Association loved the rescission of the rule. State Farm Insurance didn't love it because insurance companies would have to pay more if people are getting injured or worse things happening. So now we're getting to the decision. Justice White wrote the opinion, and started out with arbitrary and capricious, which is in section 706 of the APA, and he pretty much says that it requires a rational connection between the facts. And the facts here are just the evidence that went before the agency and the evidence that the agency considered and the comments that the agency considered, and the choice made, which was the decision to rescind. And it laid out four general factors that would make something arbitrary and capricious.
If I could interrupt for a second, this may be unfair for me to say, but there's a small chance that maybe one or two of the members of the class have not had a chance to read the case yet.
Okay.
Could you point to the particular page and the language you're talking about?
Yeah, on page 748, it's going to be that big, chunky paragraph in the middle, and where you see the italicized words endowment, Bowman transportation, it's the sentence right after that,
so,
starting with normal.
Thank you. I'll go even further. For those of you who don't mind defacing your books, draw a big block circle around this paragraph, because this is probably the most famous language, except for one other clause we'll talk about in a second, but is the operative implementation of some of the principles we've been talking about. It's excellent. It's a crystal clear distillation of the sorts of things courts will look to in assessing whether or not an agency action is arbitrary and capricious based on a record. So now, once again, having detoured you.
So we're trying to figure out what's arbitrary and capricious, since it sounds like that could be a really arbitrary thing to define. So White lays out four big indicators. The first one is that if the agency relied on factors which Congress has not intended it to consider. The second one is if it entirely failed to consider an important aspect of the program, and we'll talk back to that one in a second. And then the third one is if it offered an explanation for its decision that runs counter to the evidence before the agency, we'll hop back to that one too. And then the fourth one is it's so implausible that it could not be ascribed to a difference in view or the product of agency expertise. And then he continues to talk about the role of the court in applying the standard. Mm-hmm. He believes that the court shouldn't be making up for any deficiencies. If the agency screwed up, that's on the agency. The court's not going to clean up its mess. And he says that we may not supply a reason thesis for the agency's action that the agency itself has not given. And that really ties back to the language of the statute that said where Congress mandated that the agencies explain themselves when they
Excellent. So we basically now have the crystal cathedral of logic laid out before us. This is the metric that the court's going to use in evaluating, frankly, this incredible mess of a rulemaking that goes back over decades with wild swings of the pendulum. And Justice White, and interestingly enough, there are actually two holdings in this case. So I assume, let's start with the one that's 9-0.
Yeah, so the first holding, and the holding that everybody agrees to, was that, that it was, that it relied too strongly. So the second one was the seatbelt, was the airbags thing, and the first one was No.
The first one that I was, and I don't mean to be fishing for things that are a little bit unfair, but there really is interesting. This is a case that has a 9-0 verdict and then has a 5-4 decision, side by side. The 9-0 one is, if you stop me at any point, I'm going to offer a few things, but it's the thing I love reading about this case. Have you ever seen a more transparent effort by an agency to reach an outcome, and they're looking desperately for a rationale to support it? So the question here was the effectiveness of the mandated standard, which the agency originally, under the first standard, standard 208, remember, said could be satisfied with either airbags or safety belts, in particular, detachable safety belts, passive safety belts. And originally, it was going to be about half and half. Well, when Secretary Wheeler came into office, they went back and looked at it and said, well, based on what the
auto industry is telling us. They're going to put in 99% belts. And of those 99% belts, they'll all be detachable. And therefore, we're pretty sure that this rule ain't going to work, because everyone's going to attach the belts, so we're not going to see any safety results. Revoke it, we're done. Go home. That was the basis for the 9-0 verdict of the entire Supreme Court. So now with that, why did he say that this analysis was so patently, facially, ridiculously, horribly flawed?
So he says that it's arbitrary and capricious because they failed to consider, or they failed to even address why airbag technology should have been scrapped as a requirement. So it attacked one side, which was the seatbelts, but it was, since it was an or thing, it failed to address why the requirement for airbags needed to be scrapped as well. So mm-hmm. The agency sort of slipped up there.
Oh, I'm not sure there was a slip up there. I'm sorry, now I'm starting to veer. I promise not to talk of politics, but I'll simply say this case was sort of the climate change, emotionally charged case of its time.
And but he's sort of accusing the agency of throwing the baby out with the bathwater here by simply because it thought the detachability of seatbelts rendered that useless when it doesn't. But, you know, the agency ignored or facially ignored the airbag requirement.
Yeah, but to be fair, the agency, it wasn't a mistake. The agency wanted to throw the baby out with the bathwater because it didn't want to take a bath.
Right.
Just to make sure, yeah, I'm not being unfair, I think.
And I mean, that was reflective of what the industry wanted, the manufacturer's industry wanted at the time as well. So.
Which part?
The fact that they didn't want these decisions on them.
You mean the airbags?
The airbags.
Yeah, okay. And agreed. The reason I paused there is because the industry also
was preparing.
Well, they also were the ones who requested that the seatbelts be detachable. Surely you see the malign logic here. They essentially had a rule. The industry requested a fix to part of the rule to make it easier to implement because they wanted the seatbelts to be detachable, which is cheaper for them to install, but also makes it easier to sell to customers who might be resistant. By exceeding and giving them that break, the auto industry then said, well, because they're undetachable, we're going to make them all seatbelts and no airbags. And by the way, we expect our customers to detach them. So effectively, the very fix the agency sought was the reason they used to eviscerate the rule. So you can see, arbitrary and capricious doesn't really seem to capture it, but that's why it was 9-0 deemed to be arbitrary and capricious.
And going back to the four factors, but particularly number two, if by failing to consider factor number two, it failed to consider that airbags were the alternative to the program, so number two is important aspects not considered. That's something that would make it arbitrary and capricious. And then on number three, offering an explanation for its decisions that run counter to the evidence before the agency. For that past decade, they have, you know, gone through a lot of hearings, a lot of investigations, a lot of facts, a lot of reports, and it produced a decision that was just not in sync with the evidence before it. And that was another thing that the court pointed to as.
Yeah. There's no right answer to this, so I'm offering this for everybody, not just you, for speculation purposes. Why not point number four?
That it is implausible. I couldn't figure out. I couldn't find it, derive that from the opinion. I didn't find it in there.
No, and, you know, let's save that thinking. Because point number four, I think, may be the subtext for the second half of the decision. Jeff?
I was going to talk about that.
Go for it.
We're saving it? No.
No.
Okay.
There's no structure to the class. This is the free give and take of ideas. Take us to where the atomic truth is.
Is that how the final will be, too?
You know, I thought about, instead of being a final in written form, asking a question about drones, walking into the exam, and flying a drone, under certain circumstances where I'm asking one of you to do it, and
given you a law and asking you if that would, I'd ask you to violate the law. So no written exam. You just have to respond to a factual situation. I decided that would just raise way too many anxieties. So don't worry, it's traditional. We're going to go the old way now.
Okay.
You asked.
I did. It's fair. Okay, so I think the reason that it doesn't fall under category 4, something I just sent to Dylan mostly. I think the point is that the Reagan administration had a policy basis for making this decision, being that even if evidence showed that abandonment of this particular seatbelt passive restraint requirement would implementation of the passive restraint rule, according to the evidence, would likely lead to a reduction in the amount of accidental deaths and injuries on the road, even if a reduced percentage of the population used them because a large percentage of the population detached them. Even though that's the case, the Reagan administration made the policy decision that we would rather not spend the large amount of money it takes to implement this policy. We're going to only see a reduced benefit that we could have otherwise in a more efficient system. And so the dissent's point is that, you know, that's their call to make. It's not so impossible, like nobody could consider it reasonable.
Fair enough. And hold that thought. I want to make sure I pin down where Hugh and I were going previously, which is why the majority didn't pass pick up point 4. I'll simply offer implausible is a very loaded word. It has a sense of dimension to it where the agency has gone beyond the pale. So I'll be honest with you, you tend not to see this factor cited unless the agency acts in a truly outrageous way. So there's a certain sense of respect. I'm not saying deference, but a certain sense of only willing to call the agency when it's crystal clear. Now, that doesn't mean that it doesn't get used. And this is, as Jack was pointing out, subtext for the 5-4 part. 4 justices join Justice Rehnquist in the dissent, talking about the other half of the decision. And here, Hugh, if you could, what was the second part beyond the airbags?
So Rehnquist disagreed with the contention that the NHTSA was arbitrary and capricious in its view regarding detachable seatbelts. He pointed to the law that required standards to be practicable, and he believed that the agency met the rational connection between facts and the choice standard. And then he continued by going into the politics a little bit of the administrations and validating the use of popular opinion and sort of finding a rational connection there to justify the agency's new view on detachable seatbelts. So while Justice White felt that the agency was too quick to dismiss the safety of the automatic seatbelts and he was pointing to the detachability of it, or the agency was, Rehnquist split on that part.
Okay. And I want to come back to something you said previously in a second, but namely the last paragraph of this dissent. But having said that, what this is really about, if I can capture this, there is a spat between the judges on a study that DOT relied on to promulgate the rule that was based on rabbit purchasers. How many of you are familiar with rabbits? VW model of car that was closely associated with Portlandia type persons. Sorry, I hate to say that. Crudité eating, white wine sipping, upper class folks who voluntarily buy these cars as part of their expression of their class consciousness. I'm not going to even offer what thoughts the current model car would fit that mold now. So the thought was that this study was, the DOT said, we can't rely on this study because it has a self-selected group that's not represented the full population at large. We're going to toss it out. And that's another reason for us not to require these belts. And which Justice White replied, we don't think that
fairly accurately captures the response that you should make to a study like this, which is that still there's nonetheless data there identifying a safety risk that could be mitigated by this particular kind of belt. Go back and redo it. Essentially, Justice White was saying, we disagree with the weight you're willing to give this study. Justice Rehnquist, and I'll get into your point in a second here, Jack, said, wait a minute, that's exactly what we should be doing. Agencies specifically are created because they have the expertise to make that kind of judgment call as to whether or not a particular kind of study accurately reflects a risk and summarizes the cost and effectiveness of the rule to respond to it. So the thing I would like for you guys, I've asked you to circle one paragraph in your books. You might want to put a star by the other paragraph in this case that it's famous for. And it's one of those ones where the dissent actually says something that echoes again and again and again in future decisions. Namely, on page, sorry, it's turned one too many. 752, last paragraph. Did I hear you? Did you say 752? I wasn't listening. Awesome, thank you. Take a look at the last couple of sentences. And this is, I think, partially what Jack was saying. A change in administration brought about by the people casting their votes is a perfectly reasonable basis to reappraise cost and benefits. Elections count. Agencies faced with the exact same set of data. Based on the change of political administration, are allowed to reach a different conclusion under Rehnquist's approach because the data are weighed against a different set of priorities, a different weight given to cost, a different metric of the value of the benefits. So it's not arbitrary and capricious by definition, even if the facts don't change, for the agency to change its conclusion. Does that make sense for everybody? Sort of an important fundamental point that comes up again and again.
Wouldn't that somewhat conflate, I guess, the electoral process, because certain individuals kind of elect a representative for a totally different reason than what an agency change may be trying to implement? Because, like, you know, just say I'm electing this guy because he's saying that he's going to offer free burritos every Monday, but then he gets in office and, you know, he has a plan of like changing climate issues, and I'm like, you know, I didn't really elect him for that. I elected him for burritos. He's trying to, you know, change climate issues. So basically what I'm saying is that certain individuals elect people for totally different reasons than, I guess, a policy agency change they may implement.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I strongly agree with you. People vote for representatives for a subset of reasons that don't capture all the expectations of what that representative will do. You may vote for someone because they are strong in defense, even if you hate their policy dealing with welfare benefits or for same-sex marriage or for any other host of reasons. The problem is that's a political theory question that, unfortunately, under the law, this doesn't care. All that matters at that point is that that person who's elected, whatever the reasons every individual person who voted for had, becomes the avatar for the collective will of the population. And when he or she votes for something, that's an expression of the public will, period. There's some an intentional blurring of that sort of granularity of individual voting preference. Does that sort of get at what you're asking? Okay. Sorry, Chad, I was off on another dimension.
No, so the only difference really between the majority and the Senate outcome here is the majority sent the airbag and detachable recension, were handed back to the administrator, whereas the dissent would have just sent the recensions out. Remand the airbag and not the detachable, so no,
exactly,
back to the administrator.
That's exactly. Yeah. Bottom line is both get sent back in. But the bottom line as well is that the seed's been planted by Rehnquist that you can take account of policy preferences expressed through electoral results to change the way an agency's decision is going to be evaluated. Hold that thought. It's going to come up again in just a second in some of our other cases. But Rehnquist dissent, I just want to flag for you guys. As I've told you before, the temptation is enormous to say, oh, I'm done with the majority, let's skip the dissent. This is one that's worth knowing and keeping track of. So a few thoughts before our time starts getting a little too short. Number one, notice this is not just one change of decision. There's a gyration over decades. So one issue we might need to think about is if an agency keeps changing its position over time, does the court have to give deference to its decision? Does the agency get held to a higher standard of judicial review based on its inability to reach a consistent result? Hold that thought, because it's going to come up again when we talk about the FCC decisions in just a minute. Number two, to a certain extent, does inaction get judicial review? Remember, what ultimately is happening here is that the agency is declining to require airbags. One of the issues that this case is it's currently edited, doesn't really get into, but it was a huge issue in the case of the court, was whether or not agency inaction got the same type of judicial review as agency action. Remember, we have to have final agency action, don't we? So hold that thought as well, because it's going to come up not later this class, but next week. We are going to spend a lot of time talking about whether agency inaction can be reviewed and under what standards. And some of the most famous decisions have dealt squarely with that exact issue. So here's, okay, I'm going to pause. Questions about this decision, and it's really sort of the wellspring for a lot of the other cases we're going to talk about in terms of what standard of review applies for administrative agency action, what sort of record has to support that decision, and what sorts of rationale the agency must offer to support its decision based on that record, even if it's changing its mind and even if it takes place over a period of time. Okay. Now remember, arbitrary and capricious is from section 706 of the APA. It is for agency actions. In particular, it's the standard, it's the benchmark, it's the one you typically pull for informal agency rulemaking. It is a different issue when you're talking about adjudications. I'm going to talk about that in just a second. But I just want to make sure you guys are well aware of where we are in the matrix right now. It's not like a bad movie reference. Okay, with that in mind, I want to move ahead to the second part of the class discussion, but I also want to make sure I give respect to the work all of you have done. Namely, there is a case tucked away between our big case discussions today. We've got State Farm, then we're going to be talking about FCC and the Fox decisions. Tucked away in the middle, though, is a smaller decision, the Business Roundtable versus SEC decision. D.C. Circuit decision 2011 by Justice Doug Ginsburg. Famous in that he was nominated to the Supreme Court and was turned down and rejected by the Senate because there was a photograph of him smoking a joint marijuana at a D.C. house party. It kind of makes you wonder what happened if something like that happened today. But anyway, at the time, it was a big deal. The key thing about this case, because normally I would love to talk about it with you, but I just want to flag it for you because I'll be honest with you, it's an outlier. This is not a case that you guys will be citing in future appellate briefs or arguments. This is a case that's meant to highlight one of the examples of the D.C. Circuit kind of going outside the lane to overturn an SEC determination. The question was basically, there was a rule that was going to require boards of directors and executives to include in their proxies that are going out to shareholders, attempts by shareholder dissidents to put their candidates on the slate of the boards of directors. Now think about that. You're running your corporation. You're the CEO. You've got the board behind you. You've named your best buds to be on the board side by side with you, and then someone like, T. Boone Pickens buys some shares in your company and then offers his slate and says, not only is he offering his slate, he's going to fight you in the shareholders meeting, he wants you to include his slate in your mail to your shareholders, putting his candidates up side by side with yours. Well, to say the least, the company's looking dimly. And here's the key takeaway. Judge Ginsburg, not Justice Ginsburg, Judge Ginsburg said, the SEC screwed up. He said that they failed to offer an adequate account of the cost imposed by the rule, both in terms of actually not only sending out the notice, but the disruption to the operation of the corporation, and the benefits generated by it, namely, better corporate governance is an awfully big term that doesn't have a hard, concrete number associated with it. Now, why is that outside the lane? Why would that matter? I'm sorry, Courtney?
Saying you have to prove the benefit is different than saying that you need to prove like the opposite of the benefit or like the detriment of the benefit.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of where I'm at. Saying you have to prove it's like a positive net, like a positive net benefit on your on the company, like kind of outside the scope of that. They were saying this benefit had enough to prove that it could be harmful.
No, I hear what you're saying. To a certain extent, you're saying there's a focus on a distinction between cost and benefits, and that the agency did a bad job at identifying the cost, and they had also a corresponding failure on their part to identify with clarity the benefits, but the cost really mattered. That's when it had to bite. And I think there's some truth to that. But if I could ask perhaps a more fundamental question, unless one of you also wants to jump in. Why is a court second-guessing the SEC on the cost and benefits of a shareholder resolution rule? Did any of you perhaps in the notes afterwards said, oh, of course, when you read that Ginsburg was actually formerly the head of OIRA? Remember our little pocket agency that does cost-benefit evaluations? This decision, I think rightly so, has been viewed as a judicial attempt to essentially impose cost-benefit assessment requirements as a matter of law as part of the arbitrary and capricious standard, and where the court actively played the role of essentially second-guessing and offering its own cost-benefit analysis. Now, like I said, it's sort of an illustrative case. It's not one that's a precedent or a foundational case, but I just want to flag it for you. Normally, I'd skip over it much more lightly, but this issue keeps coming up, and at the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia has not too long ago, Justice Scalia wrote an opinion where basically he said that arbitrary and capricious as part of the requirement mandated that the agency do a cost-benefit assessment. And if it failed to do so, it was by almost definition arbitrary and capricious because of the size of the rule and its impact potentially on the economy. So the spirit of this argument still works. This is probably the clearest demonstration of it. But it's the parameters, the boundary lands as to how far, where discretion must lie and where you might perhaps go past it and get into second guessing the agency in a substantive way. So, yes?
You mentioned yesterday, was it the spirit of the decree or
the hearing? Yeah. Actually, maybe I should have done this on Tuesday.
I was
going to
say that in this case, very good example of that. Although the SEC lost here, essentially the present figures are like two-thirds of the S&P 500 voluntarily is taken on proxy access. So the issue became so politicized that in this case, the companies themselves were forced to do it.
I think that's an excellent point. I've got to be honest with you, I hadn't really thought about that way. That's a good way to put it. I'm going to graciously cede the field to you on that one. Any other thoughts, comments, suggestions?
That's a big question. So are we saying that the court can't offer its own? So if it comes to them, like review of an agency rule, then the court can only review what's given. They can't offer their own. They can't offer their own plan. Like they can only review your plan. The court can't say, well, here's our plan for this. Is that what you're saying?
In the realm of administrative law and review of agency actions, yes.
Okay.
And remember, that also popped up a little bit in the State Farm discussion as well. You can point out the hot, steaming mess the agency made, but you can't offer your solution as to how it should be done, in theory. The reason I'm offering you up some caveats is some judges do it anyway. And second, in the realm of remedies, judges do get into the weeds on exactly what an agency must do. Say, for example, they issue an injunction to halt the harm. They get to design what it looks like. But that's That's sort of a niche. An important one, but a niche. Okay?
How does what Courtney just said compare, how is that consistent with in Nova Scotia where they do the judicial independent fact finding, but just because there was no record at all?
Very good question. A, no record. B, the age of the case. They were still working out what they were going to do when they were presented with agency action within that time. But I'm also going to weasel on it a little bit. Keep that thought in mind next Tuesday when we talk about the Volpe case. All right. Any others? Okay.
So with that in mind, I offered that as a small oasis in the trek between going from State Farm to our last set of cases for today. And these are also important foundational cases that pop up again and again and again when you do citations on administrative matters. The best part about this is a set of cases dealing with obscenity, indecency, and profanity. Everyone's favorite topics. So before we get to it, I just wanted to give everyone some ease of mind. I've mentioned to you a couple different times that I was relying on one of your other classes to cover due process limits on deprivation of property, the whole Goldberg v. Kelly and the Matthews v. Eldridge cases. I didn't assign them to you. I had someone ask me this. That means I'm not going to include it in the final. You guys do not be responsible. I'm just hoping that you are aware of the fact that if the government wants to take away an administrative benefit from you, like a welfare benefit or a Social Security benefit, there is a minimal due process requirement imposed even for informal rulemaking or informal adjudication. And it may be fairly limited, but nonetheless, they're there. So with that in mind, check it. We're moving along. Now we're getting to a different breed of cases. We're going to be talking about now judicial review of not only agency action, but agency adjudication. We're now in that box, actually two boxes. Now, I'm going to make sure, this is something that's caused this confusion every year. So I want to make sure I'm very clear about this. Remember the matrix we talked about with informal, formal, rulemaking, and then adjudication. I have to admit, I kind of glided very quickly over the fact that adjudication comes in two flavors. We have formal adjudication and informal adjudication. Formal adjudication has its own standard under the Administrative Procedure Act. It's under 706, but it's a different subpart. Formal adjudication is where the Administrative Procedure Act mandates you go through certain processes of certain types of evidence, certain types of hearings, certain types of witnesses. So as a result, it's very trial-like, but by statutory mandate. And it has a separate standard of judicial review. You reviewed on a substantial evidence standard. That is not arbitrary and capricious. Is that clear for everybody? Because the cases we're about to talk about are not these cases. What we're really going to talk about is informal adjudication. Almost all adjudication by agencies is informal. To trigger formal adjudication, either the statute has to mandate it expressly, or it has to use the magic phrase, on the record. When you see those are red signs that you are going off the big highway of normal administrative work. You're going to that rare, strange, dark world of formal agency adjudication. The cases we're talking about today are in the informal box. They still look like adjudications. They still have a lot of the same things you're familiar with, but you don't have quite the same rigidity, and you don't have that same sort of, that same standard of review. Yes?
So the qualifications for formal adjudication is what it says on the record or granted by statutory language?
Yes. Usually the two are the same. The statute says on the record. But it could also say formal. All right? Yes?
Are you going to write into the red chart?
Are you criticizing my handwriting?
Oh,
I'm very impressed. That was deftly done. Substantial evidence. That's the standard review.
All right, so any questions about that so far? Because now we come to it. We're going to do something dangerous and rare. We're going to do three cases at the same time. I have to say, though, that the one that is the funnest one to talk about is the one about this.
And the winner is... Told you, boys. The Hand of the Build America, Gang of New York, Music and Lyrics, you two!
That's really, really fucking brilliant. Really great. And, you know, there's a lot of songs in films and some great songs, and a couple of U2 songs, but not often are the songs come out of the characters and out of the story of the film. This goes back to a conversation I had with Martin Scorsese over 10 years ago, and Harvey Weinstein banging and saying, you gotta do this, and...
I wanted to make sure we got Harvey Weinstein in there. Would it surprise you that complaints poured into the FCC after that? That was broadcast on prime time without any warning. This is in 2004. In a more tender and delicate time before Family Guy, South Park, the rise of cable. Well, I'll stop there. But anyway. And there was a concentrated, concerted attempt to essentially hold the network accountable, ABC, for broadcasting that. So with that in mind, Elena, we finally, now, the long end of the class, have come to the moment where you can inform us. Let's start with the first case. What was going on essentially in that case?
The
Golden Globes case.
Yeah, okay, so as y'all heard, it's a dirty word.
Well, I'm sorry, Elena, I should have said this. To anyone whose sensibilities were offended by that, I do apologize. I should have warned you in advance that there might have been that language involved. So I apologize for not being more diligent in my sensitivities. Nonetheless, I'm hoping no one here was terribly offended. Okay. Awesome. Let's keep going.
Okay, so the Parent Television Council, or TTC, brought a suit against Time Warner Cable because they wanted them to.
I'm sorry, you're going to have to speak a little slower and more slowly and more distinctly, because I'm having trouble following you a little bit, and I'm pretty sure that behind you, can you guys hear? They're very diplomatically but gently saying no.
Okay, yeah.
There you go.
So the PTC brought suit because they thought that the language was obscene and indecent, which goes against the regulations that the FCC has proposed. So they were saying that...
Well, before we go further, where did those regulations come from? Remember, agencies can't do anything unless it's a statutory mandate.
Right. Okay. Oh, I believe it's from the Communications Act.
Okay.
326.
And I've pulled that up right here. I'm not sure, maybe I put the link on this to the website as well. It's worth looking at this because I was shocked when I actually read statutory language. Basically, this is where the key words come from. Whoever utters any obscene, indecent, or profane. Notice those are three distinct terms. Remember, our statutory interpretive doctrine says that the Congress uses terms to have independent meanings. They don't have pure surplusage. So each of these has a separate meaning. By means of radio communication, notice, not TV, let's leave that aside, shall be fined under this title, here's the part, or imprisoned for not more than 2 years, or both. This is a felony. This is a criminal provision. Now, I'm sure all of you are thinking, I've got to tell Professor Rabe about this. The First Amendment issues galore. That's not for class today. It percolates under the surface of some of our statutory administrative practice issues, but I just want to remind everyone of the stakes here. It's not just writing a check. They're interpreting a statute that has some real potential possibilities in the future of being applied in a penal fashion. All clear? Because that also should be turning the wheels in your head as to how that affects the way you interpret the statute. So, Aaliyah, keep going. Sorry, I interrupted you. As you would tell you, I tend to do that.
Okay, so yeah. So the PTC was saying that it was, that the language was obscene and or indecent, so they should put sanctions against the licensees. And then they said it was also patently offensive to use that word in any shape or form on broadcast network. So they really wanted just a bunch of angry parents.
Yeah, but where is patently offensive?
Oh, well, that comes off of, because the Bureau, in response to saying that the language was obscene or indecent, said that the way that he used the word was just like an utterance and it's fleeting and isolated, so it shouldn't fall under this, and that's when they come up and say that it was patently offensive to use that anyway.
Okay. Absolutely, and in the context of that discussion, and just, they're really talking about indecent really to start.
Yeah.
But it's also an element of profanity, and that the sort of momentary utterance doctrine fits into whether or not it meets the definition of these two terms. Side note, obscene, just so you guys will know, is the radioactive term in this statute. Obscene, by definition of the First Amendment, is not protected speech in any fashion. So, as a result, we're really focused. Everyone admitted this was not an obscenity. The other argument is whether it's an indecent utterance or a profane statement. And what Alina has been saying is that it's, what was the term you used again? I'm sorry? It was patently offensive. Right. And shocking as well. So, that comes from, as she pointed out earlier, the regulation. Now, why I'm resisting terribly, this is a fascinating law. You'll be shocked when you look into censorship law, at content standards, how much censors care about which box you put words into. And they keep very close, very finely graded distinctions between how bad certain words are. I would love to talk about those with you maybe someday in a different class. But for now, remember, we are focused on one thing only, administrative practice and statutory interpretation. So I'm going to ask Alina, unfortunately, to cut to the chase a little bit. What did the court rule in the Golden Globes? Sorry, the FCC rule in the Golden Globes.
So at the end of the day, they ended up saying that it was a violation of the FCC regulations, but they didn't punish, or they shouldn't punish them because they didn't have any kind of a notice that they were doing something wrong. Or
well, I hate to say this, but this statute was passed in 1948. How could they possibly not have noticed that this was a risk?
That is a very good question.
No problem. And by the way, I don't mean to torture just Alina this morning. If anyone else wants to jump in as well, she's at least gotten us past the initial threshold.
Okay, so I think what they were saying is that the commission standards as applied to the broadcast were vague. So there was too much vagueness in it to where they shouldn't just assume that that Fox or ABC or whoever knew exactly what to do. And so they took the opportunity now that it's been brought to them to be like, this is your fair notice that in the future you will be sanctions and other conditions if this is to occur again.
So
and then that's when they offered the
okay. So the reason it's vague is because the prior agency rules didn't fairly say that this would be considered to be actionable, obscene, sorry, indecent or profane speech. In other words, it's a change from what it was before.
And also, another reason why or organs or extremities, and the way that he used it wasn't geared towards that. It was just like to emphasize something. So it was like kind of that.
Sort of the modern version of Golly.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and then they went down like a road, I'm not sure exactly which case, but in one of these SEC cases where it's like, and they also mentioned Paris Hilton, that other chick, I forget her name, the product.
I'm scared you guys know that. Actually, it was in the case. I'm fair enough. I just try to erase anything about Paris Hilton from my brain.
Anyway, so they put all comments on that, saying that a lot of words are, you know, not to be, you don't want children to hear them, but they're also have different connotations and disadvantages, like the way you say them. So if we're going to just say that this word is bad, this word bad, this particularly just to like, you know, sexual or excretory organ or activities, or are we going to expand that to cover, like, no matter how you say this word, this is going to be punishable?
Absolutely. But the whole idea that there's so much complexity in trying to determine whether or not the word in this example fits into these boxes proves the case of vagueness to some extent, doesn't it? But let me sort of take advantage and run for the ball a little bit, which is, remember, we, as much fun as it is to talk about this type of issue legally, we care about the process. We're caring about the tools. And here, the whole issue about fair notice and the whole question about vagueness and the whole difficulty of changing agency policy is actually rooted here, isn't it? This is the classic conundrum of common law. You deal with the cases before you. You deal with the enforcement actions that are handed to you. And you can make changes in policy dealing with that party. But that party, if you're changing the law, by definition, isn't getting alerted to that possibility of the law. They were relying on all the other cases before. How do you change policy when you're doing it case by case by case? When you can't issue necessarily a rulemaking, although in theory FCC could. Short line here is that you split the loaf. They basically said, here's what we used to say. Here is why we think it's wrong in this case as applied here. Here's what we're going to say in the future, but because it changes the rules, it's not fair to hold you liable for loss of your license, for fines and penalties. Notice they don't even mention the fact that it's a criminal statute. Does that make sense for everybody? Because that's an incredibly important part of understanding how courts review informal adjudicatory agency action. To a certain extent, the agency has to satisfy those minimum requirements of due process in making decisions case by case by case, while at the same time being an agency setting policy that governs everybody. How do you strike that balance? So, what I would suggest is, as time is drawing to a close, think about this, because what I'm going to do, Alina, you are safely discharged from duty, but unless you'd like, next class, we'll begin briefly with our favorite network, Fox, and Paris Hilton. And to what extent these same things we're talking about apply when they also were caught in the same change of standards, but with a slightly different setting. And here's the question I want you to think about over the weekend. Well, I'll hope you think about it over the weekend. I'd understand if instead the sun was calling and you put it off till Monday. But does the Fox decision number one, the decision written by Scalia, basically overrule State Farm? Can they exist side by side, or does it basically make State Farm largely irrelevant? I have my view on that. I'd be curious what you guys think. Okay, with that, questions? Things you want to kick around? Sorry. Did everyone hear Kyra's question? She was asking to what extent Miller v. U.S., the U.S. Supreme Court case you may have studied in another class, applies and offers a metric for this same issue. And Miller goes about seeing speech.
So not really. Obscenity is outside of the pale for First Amendment protection purposes. So you interpret language with statute. Good question. And did I say that?
No, I was just trying to
Oh, okay, thank you. All right, before we break, can I talk with my four volunteers for the B class before everyone scatters? Just so you'll know, we're going to record that and probably get it up next week. It's an important one. Please don't blow it off because it's about the use of legislative history and statute interpretation. I'm trying to make it as entertaining as possible, but it's going to be up to you to watch it. Otherwise, it won't do you any good. All right? Have a great weekend, everyone.